morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance. Fisher present.
Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Frankie present.
Backer. Backer.
Backer present.
Baker.
Baker present.
Becker Finn.
Becker Finn present.
Hanson. Hanson. Tuesday with tune. Lippert.
Lippert present.
Muller.
Muller present.
Pearson.
Pearson present.
Thompson.
Thompson present.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Cross. Now that quorum has been established, move on to the first order of business. That would be the approval of the minutes from our last meeting on March 16th. Are there any questions or corrections on the minutes? If not, the chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Thompson moves the approval of the minutes for March 16th, 2022. Please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today, so we're going to get started. I'd like to welcome Representative Pinto to the committee this morning. Good morning to you. I will move your House File 2958 be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. And Representative Pinto, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and good to be with all of you this morning. So House File 2958 is, this is old fashioned lawmaking is how I would describe it. In that this is an idea that that I had and thought that I would bring to my colleagues and had it passed to the one committee and with you now. House File 2958 would establish a task force on our statewide response to the abuse of controlled substances. I should note at the outset, that there was an amendment to just clarify that this is a reference to abuse of controlled substances. You'll notice that the phrasing in the bill currently is substance abuse. This is not intended to be aimed at alcohol or tobacco. We're really talking about controlled substances, narcotics under our law. It's an opportunity for us to step back from a public health perspective and a criminal justice perspective and a broader perspective to say, what could our state be doing better to address the abuse of controlled substances? I've had a frustration as a prosecutor. I think many of you are aware that that's my background, handling a wide variety of crimes, but a frustration that that there is perhaps more that we could be doing in this area. We know that despite the legal regime that we have in place, despite the services we have in place, we continue to have an epidemic of abuse of controlled substances. We continue to have controlled substances being sold, being distributed in our communities and ruining lives. And we want to make sure that we are taking the very best approach we possibly can. And as I've sort of asked around, as I've had different policy ideas and said, well, what are some good models we can point to? I'm not aware of what those are for the best way to handle these situations, these crimes, this abuse. And so my thinking is we've had a lot of success in other areas to step back and to pull together experts from a variety of perspectives to, frankly, get out of the spotlight of a legislative process, try to figure things out specifically in a bill. But first say, okay, you all go away, do some work together for a while, come back to us. Are there changes we should have in our laws? Are there programs we should be funding? Is there a reassurance that, in fact, the structure we have, the approaches that we're taking are the right approaches, and we need to do that much more of them, whatever it is? And I really want to tell you candidly that I don't have any expectation of particular answers or approaches from the folks on this task force. And in fact, don't feel like I have particular expertise to bring to bear except as a practitioner or prosecutor who's looking at this and saying, what more could we be doing? I will also say quite openly to you that I could imagine that there may be better ways to structure this task force. And I've already had conversations with a couple of you, but if folks have thoughts on that, I really am eager to hear that as well as the bill hopefully moves forward. So I have no testifiers, Mr. Chair, except for myself, but feel like this is a chance for us to step back and take a look at this. And I'm eager to have a conversation this morning for as much time as you've allotted, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome, Representative Pinto. Thank you for bringing the bill before us today. I appreciate the opportunity for us to have a discussion on it. With that, I will open it up to questions. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto, for this bill. I do like this bill. I like the concept. I realize, and one of the things I've always talked about, Mr. Chair members, is how addiction and substance abuse touches so many aspects of our lives, of law, of areas within all of our agencies, and how everything intersects together. And are we approaching that properly? So I really appreciate this thought process, Chair Pinto, on how can we better not only serve the people of Minnesota, but help people to get the assistance they need. And are we approaching it properly? Because it's not always just throwing somebody into the judicial system and hoping that things get better. So I'm going to take a really good look at this bill, and I'm going to be in touch with you and maybe give you some feedback on it or be a part of it. Because I really think that we need to take a more holistic look at how everything intersects and how we can use that information to move forward to better serve the people of Minnesota and the people that are just struggling. So I'll be supporting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Representative Frankie. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. And this question, and appreciate the author. I know the author has been in as a prosecutor. I'm on the other end when I show up on a scene as the EMS with substance abuse, and had a run the Sunday night dealing with that before coming down to the Capitol. Did I hear this? A couple questions. First of all, for the author, you're thinking of not including alcohol. And I know you don't have the DE amendment. So in what we have today, substance is not defined, and you're working on that. I get that, but alcohol is abused, and 40% of my runs as an EMT deals with alcohol abuse. So I thought I heard you at the beginning, Representative Pinto, that you were looking not to put alcohol in there, please.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Backer. One thing I should clarify about the amendment that will be coming is that it simply will change the references to substance abuse or substances to be controlled substances. There's a couple phrases to make a little bit different to make that work, but just so folks are clear that's all that would be. And that's not defined in the amendment either, because controlled substances is a defined term brought more broadly in our statutes. My thinking on alcohol is that I completely agree with you, Representative Backer, that in my work, I see the impact of alcohol abuse very often. I come from a domestic violence prosecution background and certainly see it there, but see it in other areas as well. I guess my thinking though is that our issues with substances that are legal but abused and have an impact on folks have similarities with controlled substances, but have some differences as well. And so I could imagine that a task force on that could make sense. Perhaps broadening this to that could make some sense too, but it feels different enough that I guess it seems like it's a big enough job to figure out sort of what we do with controlled substances that my thinking was I kind of rather not pull that in for this work as well. But I understand that could be a judgment call. And if there was a lot of enthusiasm among legislators, my colleagues, to really pull that in, I could imagine we would. I just would hate to have it dilute the work of this particular task force. That was my thinking.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Backer.
Yeah, so if I'm hearing, thank you, Representative Pinto. If I'm hearing you correctly, though, I'm still a little unclear. I want to make sure you're talking about controlled substance. Are we strictly then illegal drugs? How about prescription drugs that get in the wrong hand? Because I've been on those type of scenarios, and I know you've seen that in your line of work there, Representative Pinto.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Backer. Yeah, so that certainly would include prescription drugs because those are controlled substances. They're illegal in some people's hands, but legal in other people's hands, but it would include controlled substances. That would include prescription drugs, yes.
Okay.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And then my next question that deals with is, in your bill, you talk about jurisdictions. You know, you talk about examining approaches in other jurisdictions. Are we referring to other states, is it outside of Minnesota? Or are we just, you're looking other forms of government in Minnesota, county, local? What's your thoughts behind that, Representative Pinto, when you talk about other jurisdictions? Excuse me.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Backer. My thinking really is I wouldn't want to constrain the public health experts, police officers, prosecutors, et cetera, in this. My thinking was certainly throughout Minnesota, throughout the country. I could imagine looking at other, that they would want to look in other, potentially other countries as well, I suppose. This is just to say, like, hey, we want to have this group of experts say, look, what can we be doing? What's the best way for our state to be approaching the various issues here? And you'll see in the duties subdivision under 4, there's just a series of analyses. So I would think in general, of course, we're going to be more comparable. It says Minnesota and other jurisdictions more comparable to other states. But the thinking is let's let these folks take a look and see what approaches are being taken and where we can improve and where we can, again, confirm that we're doing it right.
Representative Backer.
That's it. Thank you, Representative Pinto and Chair Fisher.
Welcome. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. And again, good to see you again, Representative Pinto. And again, thank you for your time last night to talk about this bill. When I first read it, I'm like, golly, why are we writing a bill to tell people to get together and talk about this super important issue? And what you're doing here is really kind of saying the obvious, I think, Representative Pinto. And we've got to get the whole wheel together, if you will, to talk about every aspect of what's going on in our communities, from public health to substance use to the judicial system. And I think you're trying to wrap that up. And I think the message here ought to be for the agencies on this call right now is that we should take this and actually just do it anyway. However we want to start looking at if we have to actually pen it and put it in law, I hope we didn't feel like we should have to do that. But I think what we're doing today is, you know, and most people here know that I'm on the ORAC committee, which is the Opioid Epidemic Response Council, about our opioid and addiction stuff. We're doing services all over the state. But we haven't really plugged in a lot with the judicial system. We do have a judge on our council. We do have public safety with some corrections folks. But we did our best to try to bring in 19 people. But I think what you're trying to do is something even at a higher level of more broad-based things. So again, I think it's a stellar idea. I think that, I'd love to be able to be a part of maybe working through this more if it wants to and has the legs to move forward. I'm certainly not going to not support it today, but I do think it's something that we should continue to work on. And is it something that has to be done or should be something that more of the governor leads this conversation, because it's such an important part of our state and the public safety issues we're dealing with. And when it comes to drug abuse and the fentanyl coming in, there's just so many things right now that are moving and very fluid that I just want to say thanks for bringing it forward. And I know your heart is in the right place, and I'd love to be able to continue to support this. So thank you for that, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Baker. Representative Pinto, any comment?
I'll just note, and perhaps Representative Mullen was going to make this point. I'm not sure. I'll just say this, that certainly informal working groups and getting together can be one way of doing things. And certainly, Representative Baker, if that would be where we need to go, then there we go. But I will say that folks are so busy in their work, and there's such a help of having an infrastructure in place that I think if we can do it as a formal task force with funding, with support, you'll note that we want to have public members participate and are expecting that they would be compensated. We want to make sure public members are able to do so, because unlike other folks, they're not being paid to do it. So I think there are a number of advantages to having it be formal if we can do that. And I take your point that we want to, to the extent that we can have folks getting together and working on this in a less formal way, that certainly is a really good thing too. So, but yes, I really appreciated talking with you last night, and I'm eager to continue to collaborate and figure out the best way to structure this and make it happen. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill. And I did want to speak a little bit to the formal structure of this, and just, I haven't been at the legislature long, but in the past couple of years, I've been appointed, like many of us have, to different working groups and task forces. You know, I've written bills to create task forces, like the Sexual Assault Task Force is a good example of that, with a very formal structure, and came back with a really robust report. And we were able to pass those recommendations. Some of the task forces that I'm working on now are trying to collect data, and having a formal task force structure has enabled them to really hone in on what data they're looking for from different agencies, make those requests, get that information in a timely fashion, because we always have the deadlines of the reports to the legislature, and actually having that formality and having deadlines with reports to the legislature, I think really helps build consensus, because people know that the legislature is waiting for those reports from them. And so it really sort of forces the wrong word, but it really gets people to work together collaboratively to come up with solutions and get that information back to us in a timely fashion. So I do think the formality of this could help with some of those things.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. I don't see any other hands up. Representative Pinto, we'll go to you for final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for this opportunity to join you all. Thanks very much for the conversation this morning. And I will just reiterate the invitation. And I think Representatives Frankie and Baker especially were taking me up on this, that if you want to join me in some old-fashioned lawmaking, boy, I would love whatever reactions you may have about who's on the task force, the duties, the structure, the number, any of it. Really eager to connect with you all on that. And so please send that my way. This is sort of the best cut, and our bills get improved as they go through the process. But I do think when I reflect on some of the task forces Representative Mueller referenced, we've had a lot of success in my time in the legislature where we do send off a group. They come back, and if it's done well, can really have a terrific impact on our policymaking. And I think we would be really glad, whether any of us are around or not, in future sessions when this group comes back and can say, this is what we together are recommending that you do. And so I hope we can put ourselves on that path. So thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Welcome. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing the bill forward. There being no further discussion, I move that House File 2958 be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Mr. Kroos will take the roll. Didn't hear you.
Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Frankie.
Frankie, aye.
Frankie, aye. Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Baker, aye. Becker Finn.
Becker Finn, aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Hanson.
Hanson, aye.
Hanson, aye. Katiza Watun.
Katiza Watun, aye.
Katiza Watun, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Mueller.
Mueller, aye.
Mueller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Thompson, aye. Mr. Chair, there are 12 ayes and 0 nays.
There being no, there being 12 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 2958 is recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for your bill today and being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
You're welcome, Representative Pinto. Members, next on the agenda, we have House File 4378. This is a bill that Representative Bierman brings to us. This is a bill that still has a bit of work. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be moving the bill before us, moving the amendment before us, and then we're going to have discussions, to have the presentation, have discussions, and then we'll end up laying it over because I understand there's still quite a bit more work that will need to be done on this and work that should really still come before the committee. So at this point in time, I move that House File 4378 be brought before the committee and Representative Bierman, I see you have an amendment. Would you like me to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment, please.
Okay. I move that the A1 amendment, I move the A1 amendment for House File 4378. Representative Bierman, could you please explain your amendment?
Sure, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment, it simply removes the section and language on children's therapeutic support services from the bill. The CTSS proposal is going to be moving separately in another bill.
Okay, very good. Any questions for the author on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, if you'd like to go ahead and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill today. The Minnesota Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, CCBHCs, started as a new model of delivering integrated behavioral health care to Minnesotans. Originally, it was built under a federal demonstration, and the CCBHC model is now a benefit under medical assistance in Minnesota. Thanks goes to you and the legislature for supporting and expanding the CCBHC model as it evolves and matures. This bill is the next step in that evolution. The CCBHC model was designed with the vision to be a one-stop shop for all eligible clients to receive integrated community mental and chemical health services with care coordination and streamlined supports from our mental health system. This is opposed to clients and providers having to navigate segmented systems for care. However, there is no single statutory or regulatory authority today that recognizes all the CCBHC services and requirements under one integrated clinic entity. CCBHCs are currently required to demonstrate that they have all the underlying state-required licensures or certifications, as well as comply with unique CCBHC standards before they can be certified as a CCBHC. These current standards have conflicting timelines and documentation requirements. As a result, clinics and clients are spending more time and energies in compliance and administrative work, not less. This translates to increased costs and time for providers that are already strapped, ongoing pandemic and workforce crisis. This bill seeks to take steps to streamline the model's requirements as CCBHCs grows and evolves in Minnesota. I have two testifiers to speak further to the bill, please, Mr. Chair, and we could hear from them now. That would be great.
Okay, certainly, Representative Bierman. We'll go to questions after the testifiers. The first person we have that I have listed here is Ms. Ashley Jose. If you could please introduce yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for off mute. Thank you, Chair Fischer and members of the committee. I am Ashley Chose. I am the CEO of Woodland Centers. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today on House File 4378, the CCBHC policy changes. Woodland Centers is a private nonprofit mental health center that was established in 1958. We serve 7 rural counties in West Central Minnesota, and our mission is to support people of all ages in finding hope and recovery. Every year, we serve approximately 5,000 individuals that range in age from toddlers all the way to the elderly, and we have a very diverse array of services. And this includes 6 different licenses and 7 different certifications. So we have our Rule 29 outpatient therapy and med management license, 2 245G outpatient substance use program licenses, a Rule 36 adult crisis program, a Rule 32 detox program, a youth shelter license, ARMS certification, CTSS certification, behavioral health home certification, two ACT certifications in mobile crisis. Most recently, we were able to become certified as a CCBHC under the state plan amendment, and this was just a few short months ago in January 2022. We are now one of 12 CCBHCs in the state, and it is anticipated there are numerous other clinics seeking certification in the near future across the entire state. And I too want to thank all of you and the rest of the legislature for supporting the CCBHC model. It's really changing the landscape of behavioral health across our state. Woodland Centers began preparing for CCBHC quite some time ago, but the pandemic really put some of our efforts on hold for a period of time. And we really gravitated towards CCBHC as it's really clear this model of care surpasses any of our standard fee-for-service systems. CCBHC creates true integration of services by evaluating and treating the entire person, their physical health, their emotional health, substance use health, and their social determinants of health. It reduces silos in our healthcare system. It ensures clients have access to the care that they need. Care coordination activities within CCBHC allow our clients to have resources connecting all of their service providers together and allowing them to obtain the services that they need. Without CCBHC, clinics like Woodland Centers could not provide care coordination activities as it's not supported under standard fee-for-service models of care. Overall, CCBHC just allows us to provide excellent care, show better outcomes, and allow an improved experience for our consumers. And that being said, there are substantial challenges within the current structure of certification. There's no single statutory or regulatory authority that recognizes all of the CCBHC services and requirements under one integrated clinic entity. Instead, under current statutes, we are required to have various statute and regulatory oversights, including the general CCBHC, our Rule 29, ARMS, CTSS, Substance Use Licensure, Mobile Crisis. And all of these standards have conflicting requirements, which are really challenging to navigate and often leave us as providers with more questions than answers as we attempt to create processes and improve care and outcomes as CCBHCs. This translates to increased costs and time for us as providers and probably for DHS as well. When a problem is found or a change is required, CCBHC providers are forced to inform various licensing and certification bodies at DHS, leading to a lot of time and energy navigating the system, trying to determine who exactly needs to be informed and what do they need to be informed of in order to problem solve or make needed changes. By moving to one standard license for CCBHC, providers would have a clear line of communication to licensing, and it would be evident of who needs what information instead of having 7 to 8 different programs or staff to contact. I also think that moving CCBHC to one license would save time and money for DHS. DHS is required to complete site visits and audits of each of our licenses and certifications individually every 1 to 3 years. Site visits or audits usually require 2 DHS staff to be on site at a clinic for 2 to 3 days to review just one of these programs and services under CCBHC. So for Woodland Centers in any given year, we could have 3 to 5 audits, which equates to 6 to 10 DHS staff, 6 to 15 days of travel and hotel stays, and additional expenses related to travel. But if we combined all of the CCBH services into one license, our site visits would reduce by nearly half every 2 to 3 years, saving time and money for both us and the providers at DHS. I want to be really clear that House File 4378 is not an attempt to reduce oversight by DHS or ensure that the standards of care are not being met by us as providers. It's really meant to combine the different licenses and certifications that are required for CCBHC into one fully encompassed license, which would allow DHS staff that are well-trained in CCBHC standards to provide oversight to the entire system of care. This would reduce the administrative burden for providers and DHS. And this bill is really similar to other efforts that are going on to reduce administrative burden, including the DHS-led Universal Service Standard implementation and the Substance Use Disorder paperwork reduction efforts. House File 4378 is another attempt to improve efficiencies and effectiveness, reduce administrative burden, and improve the relationships between DHS and providers. As we grow this model of care in Minnesota, which in my opinion is gonna be the new standard of care, it's gonna be really vital that CCBHC requirements are clear, achievable, and sustainable. And I'm asking you to please support the passage of House File 4378 so that we can continue to increase access, sustain our services, and build a new service across the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Jost. Next we have, I have on my list for testifiers, Ms. Shauna Retmeer. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Shauna Reitmeier, and I'm the CEO for Aluma Incorporated. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify today on House File 4378. I want to echo everything that my colleague Ashley Chose said. I concur with that, and we experience very similar challenges as well. A little bit of background on Aluma is that we serve the rural and frontier counties of Kitson, Manoman, which is entirely within White Earth Nation, Marshall, Norman, Polk, and Red Lake counties in Northwest Minnesota. Annually, we serve about 4,300 people from birth to end of life. And this last year, we served upwards of 1,300 children and their families. I've just noticed that I am freezing up. I hope you can still hear me. My video may not, but thank you. Over the past 5 years, Aluma, as one of the original six CCBHC demonstration clinics, we also provide a full continuum of services, which includes our outpatient mental health and substance use, psychiatry, targeted case management, rehabilitation services, and many more. And when CCBHC started, as my colleague said, this is a new model of delivering an integrated behavioral health care system in Minnesota. What that meant for our region is that we were able to expand and enhance services that we've been providing, which means we're increasing services to our clients. So, for example, we were able to redesign and increase our staff to have a dedicated mobile mental health crisis team. We were able to provide care coordination to our clients to help them navigate and access services and supports that are social determinants of health, like housing, food, and other healthcare needs that directly impact their recovery. We also were able to expand our use of registered nurses in order to help coordinate care for our clients that really have complex medical health conditions. We truly believe that this model is allowing us to save the lives of the people that we're serving. Just yesterday, we staffed a client that our staff had gone to their home and they'd had a stroke. And we were able to get them that necessary care. And we have no idea, right, if that person would still be alive if our staff weren't able to come into their home. Like was mentioned by Representative Bierman, this is a one-stop shop model of care that is designed to be a no four walls approach. So that means we go to where that client is needed, whether it's their home, a school, our clinic, or using telehealth. And it's all within our Aluma continuum of care. This integrated model deserves to have an integrated approach of how we're monitored for compliance. So, like Ashley said, right now, Aluma has to demonstrate compliance through individual standalone reviews for our outpatient clinic, our substance use services, our ARMS, CTSS, mobile crisis, targeted case management, and that's also by various payers, not to mention all the other grants that we are delivering. And on top of all of that is the CCBHC certification. That's 10 different reviews that we're managing. And that administrative burden is taking our qualified clinical staff offline to monitor and oversee all of these different programs. And that means we're taking direct service away from clients, especially when we have such a workforce shortage. So my ask and our ask as CCBHCs is that since this is an integrated model of care, let's integrate the reviews into one review that meets all of the requirements as a CCBHC and put it into one license. I really want to thank you and the legislature for your support of this CCBHC model over the years, as this was a demonstration and is now moved into the Minnesota's Medicaid state plan. That's why I'm asking for your continued support with the passage of House File 4378 so we can continue to integrate this model, improve access, and continue to build our mental health system in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Reitmeier, for your testimony. And committee, I will open it up to questions at this point in time. I know that this is a good program. These are important things to do. It's important to make sure that we have streamlining going on. And I know in the past when we've had similar bills, they've usually taken a bit of work before they get out of committee here to make sure that we're getting it right, particularly on something as important as this. I see that Representative Baker has his hand up. Representative Baker, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, and thanks again, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifiers, really well done. Again, Dr. Jost is from the Wilmer area. She runs a fabulous operation out in Western Minnesota. And I tell you, understanding their work lately and the expanded services that they have been coming together, they jumped on board with this pilot project, the CCBH program. And it's a really good one. They're excited about this. And I think what we have to do is make sure that our licensing programs can sort of keep up with what their demands are. You know, in the private sector, folks, we have to figure out how to do our jobs with less people. There's nothing we can do to create more people. And that's one of the biggest problems DHS is facing right now in their workforce is that they don't have enough people to kind of get this done. They're getting it done, and yet they've got to check off the boxes because in law, we have required them to be on site 13 times, 17 times, whatever it is. And again, as Dr. Joseph said, how much are we paying with travel and overnight lodging and just staffing when we can try to consolidate this? So I'm fully behind the bill and the concept of trying to get licensing caught up to the program that it's actually serving in a much more efficient manner. And I don't know if, Mr. Chair, somebody from DHS can maybe comment on what they see on this program. If they're able to comment on this or if they've had time to really kind of look at this, I'd love to hear from them. If not, I understand. But this is something that we have to do as lawmakers. We have to give our folks in the field the tools without becoming so burdened with these ongoing regulations and licensing that, again, they've said are important to do, but we've got to find a more efficient way to do this. So thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this bill to us. This committee should really dive into this and get it right. So I want to, if it's possible, hearing from DHS, Mr. Chair, but if not, I understand. But I just want to say I'm fully supportive of this, and thank you to the testifiers. Great job for helping us really understand what's going on here. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I know we have folks from the department out there. Would one of them like to comment as to where they see we are in the process? You know, kind of give us, get to Representative Baker's questions there. And also, you know, from my understanding, there's still a lot of work to be done as where the opportunities are out there. So looking to see who might be willing to unmute and talk to us. Ms. Grob, go ahead. Looks like you're the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. So we are in agreement with the policy goals of the stakeholders in this bill. We really do want to make sure that we have a streamlined process that works for providers. We want to see this model succeed. We've been talking a lot this session about, you know, needs in the behavioral health community and really the true crises that we're seeing and the need for integration of care. And we've got a lot of systemic reform efforts underway, CCBHC being, you know, one of them, to make sure that people can get that integrated care at the primary care level. And so we do want to continue to work with stakeholders on this, and we definitely see promise in this proposal, and we'll be continuing to work with them on the amendment and kind of what makes sense. It does take some time, being that this is a newer model, a demonstration that just transitioned to the state plan. We do have to take some time and want to be careful that when we make licensing and regulatory changes that we're covering all of the bases and getting it right and not creating any unintended consequences. So we just haven't had the time yet this session to figure that out, but we are committed to continuing to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. Representative Baker.
And I appreciate, Mr. Chair, Ms. Grom's point in this. They don't have the time to kind of look at this, and I get it. And it's easier said than done, and I am not here at all to criticize DHS. You know, I was on the phone earlier this week with the commissioner of DHS, and she's just trying hard to reform this huge division of delivering services and trying to find the best way to roll out good leadership, good accounting, but also to never let licensing be laxed, but we are trying to find ways of bringing it together. So whatever we can do to our friends at DHS, we have to be here with you. And I know we're pushing hard to get this done, and you guys are overwhelmed with a lot of things going on. This is one of those that we have got to find the time to set aside to fix this thing, because we know everybody's busy, but we've got to get this thing done. And I just appreciate Christy's comments on this. And I want to stand ready to work on this as well. This is really important. So thank you to DHS for your comments today.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Next, we have Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And yes, Woodland does a lot of stuff. I'm West Central Minnesota, Big Stone. I know my twin brother serves as a county commissioner, talks highly of them. And this may be I don't know if this is an author question or DHS. How will this affect local providers with these changes? And here's where this stems. Right now, we have the agency who is really trying to, in my opinion, eliminate county-based programs because HMOs in the metro areas do not understand what goes on in Big Stone County, Traverse County, Grant County. They have no clue whatsoever. And they are, in my opinion, wrongfully, aggressively trying to eliminate county-based programs. My concern with this change is that the local providers, because I know there's a lot of work, so I guess it's somewhat of a statement, is that we don't want to get rid of local providers. The folks at Woodland knows us a whole lot more than a provider in Ramsey County and so forth, because we do have demographic difference and economic differences. So I don't know if this is more of a DHS or if this is an author. How is this going to affect the local providers with these changes here? Are we going to uplift them? Or we're going to try to say, hey, we get a little cheaper in Ramsey, but they got to drive across the state to get that type of service. So I would like that question addressed, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Bierman.
I think I can answer that, but I'm going to add, since we have two people who are in the industry in the area, I think we should defer to Ms. Joseph and Ms. Wright-Mueller, please.
This certainly would. Which of our testifiers would like to try to answer that? If you want to go ahead, unmute yourself and start your, let us know who you are and start the answer, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. This is Shauna Reitmeier with ALUMA. And thank you, Representative Backer, for your question. I think my answer in short, this model is about local providers. So this isn't about like an MCO or someone from another part of the state coming in and providing services in another area. This is about developing providers, and the whole premise behind a CCBHC is about partnering and coordinating with local entities like counties. So this is a partnership model. This isn't a takeover model by any means.
Representative Backer, excuse me.
Yes. That's okay. I've been called Baker as much as Backer down here, so I'll just take it as a compliment. Please record that, Representative Baker, okay? that's my question that I have. My concern to the author, I know there's a lot of work yet on this, is we have to keep that local provider, because then out in greater Minnesota, we have to travel 60, 70 miles because we don't get to pick our providers. Now, I'm talking about medical. I get this is, but we can go down that same slippery slope. So thank you, and that's all I have, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Next, we'll go to Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman, and I want to thank the testifiers for doing such a great job at explaining this bill. I guess, and I agree that, you know, this is one area that we do need to take a look at, as we've done in other areas, to streamline, get rid of regulation, make it a lot easier and less burdensome to perform these duties. I guess my first question, I'll start off by asking Representative Bierman, it's my understanding that there may be also another amendment coming to this bill, kind of to save time and energy maybe next week. Could you give us a quick explanation of what that is and where that's going?
Representative Bierman.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Franke, thanks for the question. So the issues are of how, in what order, and the kind of the steps that need to be taken in transitioning this process in state statutes. And so that's what the next amendment will be about. There will be further consultation with DHS to try to get this in a form that we can take those initial first steps. This may be a two-year process to do them all, but we want to just take it as far as we can in this session and see what we can work out, given the time constraints that DHS has and the amount of work that this takes to change. The important thing to remember, I think, for the committee and members is just that there's no scope of practice changes going on here. This is just all about making sure that statutes comply and that we transition this, as the testifier said, to being able to have fewer people coming in to do their examinations and inspections and make sure compliance is there, but also making it a process that's streamlined for the CCBHCs and their offices to make sure that their standards of care and their questions and answers can be related more quickly. And it is going to take some work to make sure that all fits together and can be more streamlined.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman, for that brief explanation. I think Representative Baker said it best what this bill potentially has the ability to do, not only for the providers, but for the agency, just to free up time, free up regulation, free up resources, and to just make everything, you know, more cohesive to just interact together better. One of my next questions, Mr. Chair and Representative Bierman, or maybe Ms. Grom could answer this. Do we foresee any issues in making these changes to any federal regulation or any requirements that we may get into?
Thank you, Representative Franke. I would think that it might be the department that might be best. I will see who'd like to unmute to try to tackle that one. Ms. Grom, or I believe Mr. Burdick's out there. Ms. Grom, could you give us a little bit of idea of what the complications might be in with anything from the federal government on restructuring here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Franke, we don't foresee any federal implications. We would certainly be working within our current federal authorities. And if there was a need for, you know, a state plan amendment or something like that, we would work to make that happen, but I think we have all the federal authorities in place that we need. And at some point soon, we'll be transitioning all of the clinics over to the state plan authority, and we'll have that uniform authority.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Grom. All right, well, that sounds, you know, like hopefully we won't have many issues there in the transition. I have one more question and then I'll move on, or we can move on, at least for me. Can I just get maybe the testifiers could answer this, one of them, and about the repayment and how that works and how it's gonna free up so much, because under these models, there's so many different certifications, so many different licensures that they're required. And I can only imagine the mess that it becomes when you're trying to build this out and maintain, you know, viability and be able to pay your bills and provide the service to the people who need it. And in the bill, it says prospective payment is scratched and now it's a CCBHC daily bundled rate. Do you foresee having an issue with that going forward at a bundled rate? And what's the thought process behind that? As far as, you know, is that going to be a viable model? And how is that going to work to keep you solvent, to keep you providing services?
I see Ms. Palin has raised her hand on this one. So Ms. Palin, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself, who you're with, and go ahead and offer your thoughts on the question.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, and thank you, Representative Frankie. Ginny Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And that's a great question, Representative Frankie. To that, some of the language changes that are made in this bill referring to the prospective payment system moving into a bundled payment rate, our understanding is those are really just terminology changes. The payment structure itself is not going to be changing under this bill. It was recommendations coming out of some conversations that the department had with CMS as they were working on the state plan amendment. And so some of those language changes are to align our state statute with the state plan amendment language.
Thank you, Ms. Palin. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Palin, for that explanation. Yeah, I guess I saw that, and I'm worried, like, you know, you start to bundle things together, but your costs go up over here versus over here. And if it's a bundled rate, then you're once again robbing Peter to pay Paul, and you're not able to sustain your services. So that had me a little concerned, at least for the providers, because ultimately we want to make this easy for the providers to help the people that need it. So thank you for that explanation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everybody. Good job.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Frankie. I'm not seeing any other questions at this moment. I want to say, first of all, thank you to the testifiers for being here today. I know that there's been a bit of work getting this here. I know that this is a pretty encompassing bill. We've got, including the repealers so far, 35 pages on it. And I know that the amendment is addressing some. I know there's another amendment that's going to be coming. And I know there's a commitment to make sure that this process gets done. It may not all get wrapped up in this session, but I know there's a lot of commitment to make sure that we continue working on it. I know that we have capacities not only on DHS side, but also capacities within the nonpartisan staff at this point in time with all the deadlines going on. As other information becomes available, there's a potential that we may continue to hear this bill as we go through the rest of the session. And so I want to say thank you, Representative Bierman. Was wondering if you have any final comments before I lay this bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just do also want to thank the testifiers who came in and really appreciate their great work. I want to thank the committee members who had the questions today, Representative Frankie, Representative Backer, Representative Baker. Thank you. Very good questions. You guys are vetting bills well, and I really appreciate the work you're doing and what you see in this bill. It's one of the first bills that I took on was a CCBHC bill when I first came into the legislature. And what really impressed me was the excitement of the advocates who work in this area. And they knew that this was really a turning point in the scope of treatment and the abilities of CCBHCs to produce the outcomes that we all seek. So thanks for hearing the bill. And I will enjoy coming back to talk more with you all about it, hopefully very soon.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative Bierman. And with that, I will lay over House File 2958. At this point in time, I would hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, our final bill of the day is House File 3274, coming from Chair Fisher. Chair Fisher, I see you have an amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment and explain it to the committee?
Well, I'd first like to move House File 3274 before us. I would like to move it for recommend for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. And with that, I would like to move the A2 amendment to House File 3274. And real quickly, this amendment does several things. It helps clean up language with input from DHS. And based on other input, we're helping to size this bill to more of a sustaining bill versus a capacity building at this point in time. And for that, I'll be open to any questions on the amendment.
Doesn't look like we have any questions. Members, the amendment puts the bill in the shape the author would like it. On the motion to adopt the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Chair Fisher, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you to the committee for the opportunity to present House File 3274 before you today. This is in response to the crisis and access to care for our children with significant mental health illnesses. Some of the things that we're looking at achieving here is administrative simplification that focuses staff attention on the immediate treatment needs of children, including allowing assessments to be completed for children entering care within the first 10 days of a licensed children's residential treatment facility, shifting the overnight staffing ratios for psychiatric residential treatment facilities, developing an assessment tool that identifies when a child eligible for psychiatric residential treatment facilities, and one-time funding to help stabilize our children's residential and psychiatric residential treatment facility levels of care. As we will hear from our testifiers, due to the pandemic, we're seeing more of our children experiencing acute mental illness with symptoms that require residential level of care. And in this moment, our children's residential treatment continuum is in crisis and requires this emergency response to deliver much needed care to our children. The legislation before you will preserve our existing capacity to serve and position providers to restore what has been lost so we can provide timely local responses to our children and families. With that, I'd like to introduce my first testifier, Ms. Connie Ross, for her to start the testimony.
Ms. Ross, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to speak with you today on this very important topic. My name is Connie Ross, and I'm the Administrative Director of Residential Services for North Home Children and Family Services in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. North Home's Children and Family Services provides a community-based continuum of compassionate care to children and families serving Greater Minnesota since 1990. Our continuum currently has programming locations in Itasca, Beltrami, St. Louis, Cass, Aiken, Carlton, Ramsey, and Washington counties. We pride ourselves in a seamless continuum of care model that continually develops services based on community and state need. My testimony today is on behalf of our wider provider community, serving children with a residential treatment level of need. Residential treatment providers strive to treat children with serious emotional disorders that have lived through horrific traumatic events, such as abuse, neglect, sexual exploitation, and homelessness. Most of the children we treat are struggling with suicidal ideation, severe depression, anxiety that results in panic attacks, aggression, fight or flight, mode of survival, and neurological disorders such as ADHD and fetal alcohol. We provide active treatment, including individual and family therapy, 24-hour nursing, as most of the children admitting to our care have significant medical conditions, daily supportive services for daily living, safety, and positive behavior management. The complexity and volume for calls for residential treatment has significantly increased since the arrival of the pandemic. Providers are reporting 6 to 9 month waiting lists, which is unacceptable for a child in need of life-saving treatment right now. The children being referred are presenting with high mental health acuity and are at risk of serious harm in regards to their imminent safety. Suicide attempts in our state have risen 50%. Parents, social workers, and hospitals are calling daily in despair. Without early interventions and residential treatment, we're most likely sending children hobbling into adulthood. Most recently, like many residential providers across Minnesota, we consolidated our residential programs due to workforce shortages to provide care for 40 children instead of our 72-bed capacity, which is a significant reduction in capacity. Our operational costs continue to increase with no opportunity to increase our revenue to offset these costs. Since the onset of the pandemic, we have lost $1.2 million in revenue. We continue to lose money every day in this program. Even prior to the pandemic, there were challenges to access care for children in Minnesota due to reduced provider capacity. It seems each year we lose a valued provider of residential services within our Minnesota continuum. However, the pandemic only exacerbated this. We are all aware of the headlines regarding children being boarded in our hospital emergency rooms, juvenile detention facilities, because residential providers are full and diverting the waiting lists. These settings are far from ideal for our children as they're not trauma-informed and they're not environments that are therapeutic. Many providers have closed entire programs or reduced capacity. As a provider, we receive countless calls from county social workers, hospitals, and parents regarding lack of access to care in our state. One of the many desperate pleas for help I recently received from was a mother in northern Minnesota. Her daughter has been a victim of sexual exploitation, is experiencing suicidal ideation, and hasn't been to school in 2 years, and is further a risk of homelessness. She's currently being housed in a hospital emergency room along with 10 other children because there's not an open program to meet her needs. This mother was in complete despair at the thought of taking her child home prior to her receiving treatment. She feared if she took her daughter home, she would eventually die by suicide. Due to workforce shortages, we are not able to accept this young lady at this time because we're unable to staff an additional unit. We do know that children get better and thrive upon completion of residential treatment because they graduate our programs and go on to be healthy, productive members of our society. In order to continue to treat and give every child an opportunity for a happy, healthy life, we need your help. I believe we can do better in Minnesota. In order to retain our already diminished capacity of residential beds, we are requesting that you support relief funding to retain the staff we currently have, as well as to continue with our robust hiring campaigns. Please support PRTF startup and provider grants in order to allow for providers to bring this very important level of care and capacity to our state and the additional quests that are housed in House File 3274. Without your support, I fear that we will continue to lose valued residential providers. We are in crisis that I've not witnessed in the 30 years of my career. I would like to close with the sentiment that children are our future. We all embrace this. We all know this to be true. Please model that you believe that our children are indeed valued and cared for in our state by supporting House File 3274. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ross, for your testimony. It's always heartbreaking to hear stories of parents and caregivers to trying to take care of their kids and just not feeling like it's enough. Next up, it looks like we have a Mr. Richard Wolleet. Am I saying the last name correctly?
You are.
From the Northwoods Children's Services. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Richard Wolleet. I am the president and CEO of Northwood Children's Services, located in Duluth. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you this morning. Connie did a fantastic job, I think, outlining the severity and the significance of the problem. So I won't repeat some of the things that she said. I think she articulated that really well. A little bit about Northwood. We've been around since 1883, so we've been in this community serving kids and families for almost 150 years, and we operate a full array and continuum of mental health treatment services, from outpatient services to day treatment, early childhood programs, day treatment programs, residential treatment, and group homes. We serve about 300 kids a day. About 1,000 kids a year in those various programs, and we employ about 300 folks. We find ourselves really at an unfortunate intersection, the likes of which I too have never seen, and I've been doing this even a little bit longer than Ms. Ross. And that intersection is that an already ongoing significant issue with access to mental health treatment services for our state's children and their families has been exacerbated by the pandemic, which has resulted in a workforce shortage that has further presented challenges. A little historical context might be helpful. Connie alluded to that in her testimony. In the last 15 years, the capacity in the state to serve kids at the deepest end of the continuum in residential treatment has been reduced by well over half. You know, the names of organizations that used to provide this service, they don't. colleagues of mine that for years in their array and continuum of programs just weren't able to do it anymore. Most recently, the Hills, Cambia Hills in a PRTF program in the North Metro closed. St. Cloud Children's Home recently, St. Joseph's Home for Children in Minneapolis, the Gilfillan Center in Bemidji, where I used to be the executive director. Wilder Foundation operated a number of programs in the metro area, sheriff's youth programs. The list goes on and on. So what that means is that, again, as the needs and as exacerbated by the pandemic increase, there's just less and less capacity to serve those kids. And a waiting list that we have in our program of 6 to 9 months is absolutely unacceptable. If you're a parent in crisis and you have a child, who's in crisis and you have a need, it doesn't wait 6 to 9 months. Adding to that challenge is, as has been mentioned, the significant workforce challenges that we've faced. It's resulted really in financial hardship for our organization. Last year, we operate both a psychiatric residential treatment facility, as referenced by the chairman, and we also operate a children's residential facility, which has now been pre-certified. I identify with all of the certifications that we were talking about in the last bill, but we've recently been certified as a qualified residential treatment program to meet some of the criteria under the Families First Preservation Act. Between those two programs last year, we lost about $600,000, and we anticipate about $400,000 of that in the psychiatric residential treatment facility, and we anticipate that amount doubling to about an $800,000 loss this year, which is unsustainable. We need an investment to continue to attract and retain quality staff at our expense. And with rates that were already insufficient to support our operation, we instituted effective the beginning of the year about a 10% across the board increase for our staff. We're hopeful. The turnover rates have so far this year have really been very low. So we're optimistic that that's going to continue to have a positive impact on attracting and retaining quality folks. But it would be wonderful if some of the incentives that we put into place, such as our loan repayment program, scholarship program, training bonuses, and all of that, could somehow be reimbursed. Programs, after all, are people. They're not models, and we need to be able to attract and keep quality folks to do the work that we do. We operate here at Northwood. Our goal, our aim is to have that full continuum of services available, particularly to kids from northeastern Minnesota, but not limited to those kids. We serve children from all over the state in our residential programs, about a third from this area, about a third from the metro area, and about a third from the rest of the counties in Minnesota. But our aim is to really have that full continuum so we can do the right thing at the right time and maintain that connection with families as they move either up or down our continuum of care and hopefully don't need our scaffolding support anymore. We get outstanding outcomes. The last research project that we did in our residential programs, one of my colleagues was doing his PhD research. And so we interviewed all of the kids that had been discharged in a calendar year. And we looked at basic well-being issues such as have they needed more intense mental health services since they've been discharged to their discharge resource, be it home or adopt a family, foster home? Are they engaged in the community, going to school? Do they have friends? Do they have a job? What's their self-report about how they're doing? And what we found 2 years later that about 75% of those kids were doing well or really well, that on those dimensions of well-being, they were performing well. That leaves about 25%. About half of that group were doing okay, and about half weren't doing very well at all. But given the complex trauma that most of these kids have experienced in their lives, that's really pretty astounding outcomes. I can tell you, it's really about people. And a couple of recent stories that might help illustrate it. I frequently get unsolicited comments and feedback from parents and ex-students. And I got one recently from a mom who sent me an email and said, "Hey, I'm so-and-so. My son was in your residential program at your main campus. We have two residential treatment campuses, as I mentioned, about 15 years ago. And I just wanted to give you an update. He graduated from the University of Minnesota Duluth with a degree in electrical engineering. And he is currently employed with the Grumman Corporation in the aerospace division. He's literally a rocket scientist. Who knew that Northwood was in the business of developing rocket scientists? But there you go. Just this past weekend, we had an event. This summer, I got a call now a gentleman, 47 years old, who lives in Florida. And he was coming up to go on a trip in the Boundary Waters with three of his friends. He asked if it'd be okay if he stopped by to visit with us and show his friends, where, as he put it, where he grew up. And he said he was such a charming guy, military vet, honorable discharge, 20 years, as I mentioned, a successful businessman. And he was a kid who was an adopted young man and was in a not so great situation with his adoptive family. So we helped find him a foster mom. He brought his foster mom to the event that we had Saturday night. So if there's ever anything I can do, because you guys saved my life, I want to be there for you. So he came with his foster mom, and we had about 200 people at the event. And there wasn't a dry eye in the place when he talked about his journey and his story and how broken he was and what we did at Northwood to make him more whole. And it was the little things, relationships, going skiing in Vail. One of our staff had access to a condo there, getting up to stay up late to watch LA Law on TV, thought he might be a lawyer because of that experience. He couldn't have been more grateful. And those are just two of the recent stories. The PRTF, just a little bit of background. Y'all approved that level of care about 5 years ago. And it was designed to be a very intensive level of residential treatment, somewhere between a psychiatric hospital and at that time a children's residential facility. Really, the criteria for admission are only those kids that have not been successful at any other level of care in ameliorating or hopefully resolving their most significant symptoms and issues. So the array, really the aim was to provide that level of intensive care and really to hopefully expand capacity again to serve kids needing intensive services, and also secondarily to prevent kids from having to go out of the state of Minnesota to receive that care. Very rigorous standards that are promulgated by the Center for Medicaid Services in terms of what needs to be in place. There needs to be a psychiatrist that directs the care plan. We need to have 24-hour RN nursing coverage, more frequent reviews of the treatment plan, more frequent individual and group therapy, a higher intensity of staff ratio of direct care staff to kids. And the results have been phenomenal. I mean, the program itself, because of those additional resources that are embedded and in the program and required by the program, it's really been a tremendously efficacious program. We offer really trauma responsive care in a beautiful setting. I always say a picture's worth a thousand words. Any of y'all at any time are more than welcome to come to Duluth to visit. I wouldn't recommend it right now. We haven't quite gotten through the springtime wintry mix. We had about 6 inches of additional snow, but I would welcome any members of the committee to visit at any time. My hope in this bill is to really, really be able to sustain the capacity that we have in these really challenging times to be able to offer those intensive mental health services to kids that we have. So thank you for your time and thank you for your support.
All right, thank you, Mr. Woolley, for your testimony. I do have a Ms. Kirsten Anderson on my list, I believe, just here for questions, if I'm correct. Okay. So at this time, I would turn it over to questions from the members. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Just trying to navigate my mouse here. Thank you, Chair Fisher, for bringing this bill forward. We all know it's much needed. I have a few questions and concerns. I guess one of my first questions is in your amendment, it deletes 8 and inserts 6 when it comes to the living unit requirements. With the staffing shortages and capacity issues, do we see this being an issue? I know that, you know, this is providing one-time funding to help, you know, alleviate a lot of these problems, but is that kind of counterproductive? If we're already not having enough staff, we're reducing the amount of supervised people. So just kind of wondering how we foresee that decision being made and going forward.
I guess Chair Fisher, do you want to first crack at that, or?
I will defer that to Ms. Anderson.
Ms. Anderson, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, my name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire Minnesota. Representative Frankie, thanks so much for your question. You know, this is a topic that's been under discussion for quite a few years, actually. PRTF came into the state newly in 2018, and these standards were set up by a number of stakeholders sitting around the table deciding that one day it was going to be the best ratio. Well, as we have implemented this level of care, we've realized that 1-to-8 is really, 1-to-4, which is the previous standard. 1-to-4 staff to young people who are sleeping during the night is really not the best standard of care. It leaves staff languishing with not much to do during the evenings. And as you stated, we're in a staffing crisis. And so this number, the 1-to-6 number, was where we arrived with the negotiations with the Department of Human Services and their input from lots of other sources.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you for that answer. I guess I'm not sure if I get you correctly, because it changes the number here from 8-to-6, not 4-to-6.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, that was the amendment. So originally we have had many discussions. The standard was 1-to-4. We proposed 1-to-8. The department came back and suggested 1-to-6. And so that's what their amendment reflects.
Representative Frankie. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Got it. So that does help. Appreciate that. Yeah, I guess and another concern of mine is this one-time funding, and I appreciate it. Chair Fisher, I'm kind of wondering why the reduction from the 10-5 down to 2-5. Is that just what we're thinking we can get? I see that it's been changed from general funds to the ARPA money, which is great, but is this just, you know what I mean? Why not stick with the larger number?
Chair Fisher. Thank you, Chair Frankie. Yes, this is one that we've had discussions on back and forth, is trying to figure out what is the right number to be at. And we're feeling that with where we are right now is that while it's great to try to build more capacity in the program, right now we're in the crisis of just trying to sustain where we are. And so just making sure that we can get the dollars to make sure that we're able to sustain and have that support at sustaining before we try to start pushing it further to try saying that we'd like to grow it. We'd all love to grow it. And at the same time, if we're in crisis where we're not even sustaining where we are, we want to make sure we're getting that focus across saying, hey, this is the minimum it's going to take. And if we don't have that, things are going to further deteriorate. So what we're trying to do is use that as a message to get that point across.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you, Chair Fisher. Yeah, I guess my biggest concern here is, you know, just like any of these bills we're doing this year with the one-time funding and a good use of these ARPA funds, I mean, you know, definitely in this area it's needed. But going forward, I mean, the biggest thing that just keeps coming back to my head is retention. You know, we can help, you know, subsidized training, we can help, you know, forgivable loans to get people, you know, the education that they need to, you know, attain these jobs. But are we going to fall off the cliff, and how are we going to do that going forward? So this isn't necessarily a question. It's just hope and an observation that going forward, you know, the word that just keeps coming back to my head is retention. How do we retain people in these fields to provide these services because they are needed. Just one more question and then I'll be done. In the bill, it says it gets to aftercare, and I was just kind of wondering, on 5.22, it says if a child requires treatment in certified qualified residential treatment program, the final qualified residential treatment program to serve the child must deliver aftercare services to the child and child caregivers. What's currently happening that we have to have that language? Is that not being provided, or why was that inserted?
Okay, thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you, Representative Frankie. First of all, I'm going to go back. I'm going to also rely on our testifier here, probably Ms. Anderson, to help out. But I think if I'm remembering right, as we were going through the amendment, I think the amendment deleted that section there, and things were reconfigured with the amendment to address. And if I'm looking at it right, if I remember right, that was being more identified on, in the amendment on page 2, lines 2.29 through 3.25, or 3.2, I think, where that was all being brought together by identifying assessment tools and levels where they would be better addressed. And I'll go to Ms. Anderson to make sure that I'm not getting that right, because the amendment changed things. We weren't trying to lose things, but we wanted to make sure that things were brought together in a more consistent way. So, and I could have been slightly wrong, but I do want to go to Ms. Anderson to correct me if I hit anything wrong on that.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, yeah, thanks for that question. So we're talking in this proposal about a qualified residential treatment program, which is what Mr. Rolit spoke to, as well as psychiatric residential treatment facilities. And that QRTP was this new standard created by the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, and that federal mandate required that the statute reflect the new aftercare language. And there also, it is removed in the amendment, as Chair Fisher referenced, due to the fact that last year we decided to put into action a working group to figure out how best to deliver the aftercare across this continuum. And so we agreed with the department that we could keep the concerns that we brought forward in this proposal in that working group moving forward and keep it more as a practice question. And to your question about aftercare, I think that organizations do deliver aftercare and support to kids and families based on their interest and capacity. It just hasn't been a mandate from the federal government, as we did see with Family First Prevention Services Act. The question before us now is to make sure that's uniformly sustainable from a funding and implementation standpoint.
Representative Frankie, any follow-up?
I guess after that answer, my follow-up question would be, so by removing this, we will not see any federal repercussions?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, you're accurate. There won't be any impact from the standing with the federal government.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Fredericks. Thank you, Chair Fisher. That's all I have.
Good. I don't see any other questions. So, Chair Fisher, last word is yours.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I want to, first of all, thank the testifiers who were able to be here today, particularly Mr. Wolleet. It was great to hear about the fact that you had a rocket scientist come out of your program there. I would have never thought that rocket scientist would be down into the behavioral health area. So thank you for sharing. Ms. Ross, thank you for sharing and educating us about how you folks are operating and what you bring to help address the needs of our youth that are out there. And with that, I want to say thank you to the committee and ask for your support to continue work so that we can continue this on in the process.
All right, there being no further discussion, I move that House File 3274 be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee.
Mr. As Gross, amended.
As amended.
Thank you.
Mr. Gross, please take the roll.
Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Frankie.
Frankie, aye.
Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Baker, aye. Becker Finn.
Becker Finn, aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Hanson.
Hanson, aye.
Hanson, aye. Katiza Watun.
Katiza Watun, aye.
Katiza Watun, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Baker, aye. Mueller.
Mueller, aye.
Mueller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thompson. Thompson. We have 11 ayes and 0 nays.
There being 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 3274 as amended is recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Chair Fisher. And with that, the gavel is back to you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today for everyone to have the discussions on the bills. Next week, we will be meeting on Wednesday, March 30th, and this will be primarily informational, focusing on a number of areas. We're going to be looking at hearing on the opioid settlement. We will have Representative Baker and Representative Olson before us, as well as representatives from the Attorney General's Office and MDH to talk about the opioid settlement, where we are, what's going on, and with the bill that they have going forward. We're also going to be hearing about a bill from Representative Stevenson about creating a Department of Behavioral Health, as a bill as I have that's trying to develop a overall model that was used years ago in another area to better coordinate behavioral health between all the different departments that we have out there. So please keep an eye out for details. There is also a possibility that, you know, we're in final deadlines coming up here for the second deadlines next week, that there may be other things that might pop up. So there is still the outside chance that there could be an additional hearing on Friday, April 1st of next week also. That right now is a tentative, and if we need it, it will be there. As we have more information, we'll communicate that out. Otherwise, I want to say thank you, everyone, for being here today. Thank you all for the hard work and the great questions. And with that, we are adjourned.